some unknowing and prominent bite mark expert. By chance, Plourde chose Michael West for his test. In October 2001, Plourde and his friend James Ricks conceived the plan. Ricks called West and introduced himself as Phil Barnes, a private investigator who was looking into the unsolved rape and murder of an Idaho college student. The crime was fictitious. He asked if he could send West some crime scene photos and a dental mold of the teeth of his prime suspect. West agreed. Ricks then sent West the photos of the bite mark on Kim Ancona's breast, the one used to convict Ray Crone. The dental mold was from Ricks's own teeth. He also sent a check for $750, West's retainer. 2 months later, West sent back a letter and accompanying 20-minute video. In the video, West meticulously explains the methodology he used to match bite marks to dental molds. Using the photo of Ancona's bitten breast and Ricks's dental mold, West walks the viewer through his process, eventually reaching the conclusion Plourde and Ricks suspected he would. The mold and the photos were a definite match. Notice as I flex the photograph across these teeth how it conforms to the outline very nicely, West explains. The odds of that happening if these weren't the teeth that created this bite would be almost astronomical. West adds that the matching patterns he found between the photo and the dental mold could only lead an odontologist to one opinion, and that is these teeth did create that mark. To watch the video without knowing the context, it's easy to see how juries found West convincing, at least when it comes to bite marks. He intermingles dental and forensics jargon with ease. He's confident, as if he's done it all 100 times before, and he had. He really appears to know what he's doing. But to watch the video while knowing the story behind it shows how frighteningly easy it was for West to convince juries of things that simply weren't true. Over the next 15 years, defense attorneys in Mississippi repeatedly tried to bring Plourde's sting to the attention of Mississippi courts to persuade them to finally stop certifying West as an expert witness. It still wasn't enough. Kennedy Brewer spent 23 of every 24 hours isolated in a cell on Mississippi's death row at Parchman. It gave him plenty of time to worry about his appeal. He had heard nothing from his lawyers or the courts. So he wrote a letter to his attorney. "I just been wondering," he began, "since I haven't heard nothing in a while, it would be good for me to know if everything the same or have anything change." Brewer's lawyer wrote him back, but only to tell Brewer that he was no longer handling the case. The trial court had appointed 2 different lawyers to draft and file Brewer's appeal, but neither had been in touch. Several months later, Brewer still had heard nothing from his new appellate attorneys. So he wrote his trial lawyer again to see if he had any information. "I hope that I am not worrying you," Brewer wrote. "It just that since I've been over here, a guy almost got executed, all because his attorney didn't file this certain motion in court, and all I want to know is where my case stand, because I don't want that to happen to me." The trial court had appointed Brewer a lawyer to handle his appeal, or at least gone through the formality. The first lawyer the court appointed had never participated in a jury trial, nor had she ever worked an appeal. Shortly after her appointment, she became ill and requested the aid of another attorney. The trial court obliged, this time appointing an attorney who had limited experience practicing criminal law, and after reading the trial transcripts and considering the severity of this matter and the consequences if the trial court's decision was affirmed, asked to be removed from the case. With both of Brewer's initially appointed appellate attorneys out of their league, the court finally turned to a more senior attorney who had experience in both trying and appealing serious cases, Richard Burdine. Burdine's legacy is a complicated one. He's a black lawyer from Mississippi who for decades has willingly accepted appointments to represent indigent defendants when few others would. In 2014, the Mississippi legislature publicly commended Burdine. The House commendation was titled, A Resolution Commending the Historical Legacy, Reputable Iconic Career, and Esteemed Service of Mr. Richard Burdine as a distinguished member of the state of Mississippi's legal community and one of the state's most illustrious and oldest African-American attorneys. But Burdine's name is also well known to Mississippi courts, and for less laudatory reasons. By the time he was appointed Brewer's appellate counsel, Burdine had already been subjected to disciplinary action by the state bar on numerous occasions. In 1988, he represented a 19-year-old high school senior involved in a fight that led to a fatal shooting. Burdine made no effort to request that the state turn over its evidence to him prior to trial, didn't subpoena any witnesses, and then failed to file a timely appeal after his client's conviction. The Mississippi Supreme Court later reversed the case, writing that Burdine had failed to perform any act basic to the defense of the accused. In 1996, Burdine failed to file a burglary defendant's appeal on time, despite two reminders from his client. Burdine's failure cost the man his chance to appeal. In a 1996 death penalty case, Burdine's opening statement in the penalty phase was just 8 lines long. The Mississippi Supreme Court did not find his actions constitutionally deficient. That client was sentenced to death. So perhaps it wasn't all that surprising when Kennedy Brewer's first attempt to appeal his conviction and sentence failed. The Mississippi Supreme Court denied every one of his arguments, including his claim that West should not have been permitted to testify. Brewer next sought to have his case heard by the U.S. Supreme Court. They declined to hear his case. 2 days later, the state of Mississippi filed a motion to set Brewer's execution date once again. Brewer returned to the Mississippi Supreme Court in 1999. He wanted permission to perform DNA testing on the sperm that had been found in Christine Jackson. Shortly after Brewer's original trial, his lawyers had been given access to the DNA for testing, but at the time, DNA technology was too primitive for such a small sample to be useful. They feared that if they tried to test it, they might destroy the evidence for future analysis. By the turn of the century, the technology had improved. Brewer's legal team sought to have the evidence tested. The Mississippi Supreme Court initially turned them down, although, to be fair, Brewer's attorneys at the time hadn't made the best legal arguments, but even in declining Brewer, the court did leave the door open to a future challenge. After another challenge from Brewer, the court reversed itself and ordered the trial court to hold a hearing on the issue of testing. In April 2001, Brewer was finally granted permission by the trial court to test the sperm evidence. They sent it to a lab in New Orleans, which found that the sperm belonged to at least one, and perhaps two, unidentified males. Neither of them was Kennedy Brewer. To that point, in almost every instance in which a defendant had been given results excluding him from DNA found in a rape victim, the defendant was promptly released from prison. Not in Brewer's case. When Brewer returned to the Mississippi Supreme Court, this time to ask that the court dismiss the charges against him, the justices turned him down. Though the court agreed that the results of the DNA evidence were compelling, it also found that the DNA evidence does not prove conclusively that Brewer did not murder the victim, and there was sufficient evidence in the record indicating Brewer's involvement. The evidence the court was referencing, the only physical evidence in the case, was West's bite mark claims. The court then remanded Brewer's case to the trial court. To his credit, Forrest Allgood didn't object to the DNA testing, but he also didn't seem particularly moved by the results. Not only was Allgood determined to retry Brewer, he planned to put Michael West back on the stand as the star of that trial. He had to. It was the best evidence he had. In a just world, the test results would have prompted Allgood to reopen Christine Jackson's rape and murder investigation and immediately free Kennedy Brewer. Instead, the case became a murder prosecution in search of a theory. Under one of Allgood's theories, Brewer, LaShawn Williams, and Duane Graham all participated in Christine's rape and murder. Allgood had what he believed to be solid evidence. A jailhouse informant allegedly told Allgood's office that while he was in the Noxubee County Jail, Brewer confessed to him that he was forced at gunpoint to bite Christine while Williams and Graham raped her. The claim was baffling and implausible, but Allgood apparently thought it had some merit, so asked Williams and Graham to submit to DNA testing. They were promptly excluded as the sources of the sperm. This, too, wasn't enough to persuade Allgood of Brewer's innocence. Kennedy Brewer had been arrested within hours of Christine Jackson's disappearance. When he was excluded as her rapist some 15 years later, no one seemed in much of a hurry to try the case again. Brewer would languish in prison for nearly 6 more years. The initial DNA test results may not have freed Kennedy Brewer, but they did again thrust Michael West into the national spotlight, bringing yet more negative media exposure. In 2001, Newsweek profiled West, calling him a clutch witness who was affable and supremely confident, but also noting West's growing number of critics, who West said were driven by ignorance and personal jealousy. But the article also provided space for the broader argument against bite mark evidence in general, an issue that to that point had been less discussed. Newsweek referred to a recent proficiency test given to 25 bite mark analysts, including West. Each analyst was given 4 sets of bite marks and asked to match them with 7 sets of dental molds. The experts who made a positive match had an astonishing error rate of 63.5%. This was the same field whose practitioners had compared their proficiency to fingerprint or DNA evidence. It wasn't just West. These analysts were putting people in prison. Parroting the party line, West told Newsweek that he still believed Brewer to be guilty. "Just because the DNA isn't his doesn't mean the bite marks aren't his," he said. He then told the reporter to stop bothering me. After the story was published, West complained about it to local media, insisting that the national criticism was inaccurate and likely orchestrated by well-funded death penalty opponents. "The national interest is not in my work, it is in the death penalty," West told the Clarion Ledger. "In a murder trial, when the death penalty is not involved, there is very little interest. When the death penalty is, it is amazing the money and interest that comes into play. Opinions are based on science or on who wrote the check. My opinions are based on the science." The following year, West was profiled on the CBS News program 60 Minutes. Though the profile was far from flattering, West speaks of the profile as a professional accomplishment. Steve Croft interviewed John Kiko's attorney, who called West a dangerous, dangerous witness. When Croft asked West how bite mark evidence compared to DNA or fingerprint evidence, West didn't stop at calling them similar. He claimed that his field was actually superior. "If you look at bite marks, you don't walk into a woman's house and borrow a phone and accidentally bite her on the arm," he said. "You have to be in a violent contact with that individual to deposit a bite mark. In that light, bite marks are better than fingerprints, because they not only show that you were present, they show you were in a violent confrontation with that individual." West told Croft that he had testified 73 times in 9 states, resulting in convictions that had only been overturned 3 times because of his testimony. "I'll take that percentage rate of error," West said. As John Holdridge pointed out to Croft, West was boasting about an error rate of 6-7%, far too high when the consequences are life in prison or the death penalty. But even that figure wasn't quite right. West only counted the cases in which a judge had determined that his testimony wasn't based on sound science. It didn't include wrongful arrests or cases where prosecutors had decided to drop the charges on their own. It also didn't include Kennedy Brewer and LaVon Brooks. As Haynes' autopsy load continued to pick up, so did criticism of his work, including in cases where he appeared to have taken shortcuts and made questionable findings. Ken Winter, who served as crime lab director in the early 2000s, says that every year he would allocate part of his crime lab budget to hire a new state medical examiner. Every year the legislature took it out. "You have to understand, the coroners and prosecutors loved Hain," Winter says, "and with the counties paying his fees, the legislature didn't have to fund a state office and staff." In October 2002, a grand jury indicted a man for the murder of a woman whose partially clad, skeletonized body had been discovered on the side of a road in Rankin County. Hain did the autopsy. Under cause of death, he wrote, "changes consistent with suffocation/strangulation." 2 years later, the defendant's attorney sent Hain's autopsy report to Harry Bunnell, a forensic pathologist in San Diego, who at the time sat on the Board of Ethics at the National Association of Medical Examiners. In a preliminary letter back, Bunnell called the quality of Hain's report pathetic, adding that the failure to obtain specimens and perform toxicology testing in this type of death borders on criminal negligence. In November 2004, Bunnell sent his full review of Hain's work. It was more scathing still. He wrote that Hain's favored cause of death was near total speculation. Because the body was in an advanced state of decomposition, the description of the remains in Hain's report would have been consistent with nearly any cause of death. The defendant eventually pleaded guilty to manslaughter. When asked about the case in a deposition years later, Hain claimed that the defendant's plea vindicated his work in the case. Hain had made similar claims about a partially skeletonized body in another case. In 1999, after the remains of Tanya Ward had been found in a wooded area of Jefferson Davis County, Mississippi, Hain testified that she had been strangled to death. But there was no neck tissue left on Ward's body to examine. In that case, the defendant was acquitted. As Hain did more and more autopsies, testified in more and more cases, and gained more and more influence, the courts seemed to give him more latitude to testify outside his area of expertise. In murder cases like that of Tavares Flags, he took full advantage of the opportunity. In April 2005, Flags was accused of murdering a man during an altercation. Flags never denied killing the man, but said he had done so in self-defense. At trial, Hain testified that blood spatter patterns at the crime scene supported the prosecution's theory that Flags was the aggressor, and he hadn't been defending himself. There are multiple problems with Hain's testimony. First, blood spatter analysis in general is a controversial field. It has been roundly criticized by scientific bodies like the National Academy of Sciences. But even if one were to accept blood spatter analysis as scientifically sound, Hain was never presented as a blood spatter expert at the trial, only as a pathologist. Nothing about the skills and experience required to be a medical examiner would automatically qualify someone to give an expert opinion about blood spatter patterns. Nevertheless, over Flags's lawyer's objection, the trial court allowed Hain to testify. He then told the jury that given the pattern of spatter, the victim was moving in a backward position away at the time of his injuries, and that the spatter was produced as he raised his arm and hand in a manner that was consistent with defensive posturing injury. There was another, more severe problem with the blood spatter testimony. As Flags's attorneys from the Mississippi Innocence Project wrote in their petition to the court, Dr. Hain provided testimony concerning the discolorations on the hallway walls that were presumed to be, but without any evidentiary support, blood spatter, adding, the blood spatter was never tested in order to determine whether it was in fact blood. Nor, it follows, was there any determination about whose blood it was. The only evidence for the alleged blood spatter were crime scene photos the state introduced into evidence, and Flags's attorneys argued that the state offered no evidence Hain even examined those. If the state did test the discolored portions of the walls to make sure that, A, it was blood, and B, it was the victim's blood, one would assume it would have introduced those tests into evidence. It didn't. Even in its response to Flagg's petition, the state didn't contest that the alleged blood spatter had never been tested, instead arguing that, even if Haynes' testimony had been admitted in error, it was harmless error. That is, the remaining evidence was sufficient to find Flagg guilty. When Flagg appealed his conviction and life sentence, the Mississippi Court of Appeals summarily dismissed the blood spatter controversy and Haynes' testimony by finding that our Supreme Court has indicated that forensic pathologists are qualified to give opinions regarding blood spatter. Therefore, while there was no mention of blood spatter analysis during Dr. Haynes' expert qualification, we cannot say under the circumstances of this case that the trial court erred in allowing Dr. Haynes to testify regarding blood spatter. George Washington University law professor Jonathan Turley wrote about Flagg's case in 2014. No one reading this record could come away with anything but disgust for the handling of the prosecution, he wrote. Turley also criticized the dismissive ruling in one of Flagg's later appeals. Yet the conviction has been upheld by three Mississippi courts and a federal court of appeals. Flagg is still in prison today. Cleared by DNA testing, but still locked in a cell and condemned to die, Kennedy Brewer finally decided to take it upon himself to save his own life. He wrote yet another letter to his lawyer. "Could you send me about $60 to get me a typewriter?" he asked. "What I am doing is fixing to get involved in learning the law, because I just can't spend my life in prison for nothing. That's why I try to learn more and about the law each day." Brewer's lawyer never sent either money or a typewriter. But Brewer continued to learn everything he could about the law, devouring any legal-related newspaper articles or magazines he could get his hands on. In the back of one of those magazines, he saw an ad for an organization that seemed promising. So Brewer pulled out a piece of lined notebook paper and a pen and began writing another letter. "Dear Mrs. Green," he began in careful script, "how are you today? I know you probably don't know me, but the reason I'm writing is can you help me out concerning my case? I really, really, really would highly appreciate it." 4 days later, Brewer's letter arrived at the Innocence Project in New York. Chapter 13, The Unraveling. And the horrible thing about all legal officials, even the best, about all judges, magistrates, barristers, detectives, and policemen, is not that they are wicked, some of them are good, not that they are stupid, several of them are quite intelligent. It is simply that they have got used to it. G.K. Chesterton. Sometime around 2006, Stephen Haynes and Jimmy Roberts had a falling out. One former Roberts staffer said the spat had been building for a while, but came to a head when Roberts started billing Haynes for supplies, and Roberts' staff began complaining about the hours they had to work to accommodate Haynes' schedule. In a 2012 deposition, Haynes offered a different take. He said Roberts's monopoly on the business of transporting dead bodies for the counties had begun to fray. Some counties had purchased their own hearses. Other wealthier counties had bought several and had begun transporting bodies for neighboring counties for a fee. New private competitors had also sprung up. According to Haynes, Roberts was losing money, which created friction between Roberts and the other coroners. That friction could have threatened Haynes' relationship with those coroners too, so Haynes parted ways with Roberts. But Haynes already had a new plan in the works. In 2006, Commissioner of Public Safety George Phillips offered Haynes a contract that gave him the non-compensated position of Chief State Pathologist. That specific title didn't exist anywhere in Mississippi law. It was invented. But it certainly sounded official. Under the contract, Hain would continue to teach training classes to coroners, and he could continue his private autopsy practice. More importantly, the contract allowed Hain to use the state crime lab for his private autopsies at a low rate of $100 per procedure. The state of Mississippi would also foot the bill for his supplies and give him use of an office. Hain now had the title and the facility and was doing more autopsies than ever. He was no longer reliant on Jimmy Roberts. He was at the height of his career. Soon, it would all begin to unravel. The years 2000 to 2008 were the busiest years of Hain's professional life, and it's probably safe to say that a day in Stephen Hain's life at that time was unlike a day in the life of just about anyone else. In 2008, an opposing attorney in a civil case subpoenaed Hain's autopsy and testimony records for an 18-month period in 2007 and 2008. Those records give a more complete picture of Hain's jaw-dropping schedule. On September 10, 2007, for example, Hain testified for a case in Jackson and performed four autopsies. The next day, he traveled 160 miles to Marks, Mississippi, testified, traveled back to Jackson, and performed three more. The following day, he again testified in Jackson and completed five autopsies. The next day, it was 118 miles to Greenville for court testimony, then 90 miles back to the town of Marks for testimony in a separate case, 170 miles back to Jackson, and four more autopsies. The four-day total, five court appearances, 16 autopsies, and over 700 miles of travel. The following day, he did six more autopsies. According to these records, as well as a review of Hain's court testimony, over one 48-hour period on January 22 to 23, 2008, he testified in Clarksdale in the Delta, Magnolia and Columbia in the far south, and Forest in central Mississippi, and knocked out seven autopsies. But Hain's most impressive two-day stretch during that 18-month window came on April 3rd and 4th, 2007, during which he testified in Jackson, Hazelhurst, Tunica, and Yazoo City, and also performed nine autopsies. Recall that through all of this, Hain was also working a job at a kidney research lab and another at a local hospital, each of which paid him over $100,000 per year. Not surprisingly, Hain made some particularly egregious mistakes during this period. One Mississippi attorney, for example, recalls a murder case in which Hain noted in his report that he had removed and examined the decedent's ovaries and uterus. The problem? The victim was male. The defendant in that case still pleaded guilty. In 2007, Mississippi Department of Corrections inmate Randy Cheney was exhibiting signs of sepsis. He had been complaining about a worsening infection, but had instead been given medication for an irregular heartbeat. When his condition worsened, he was transported to Parchman Hospital at the Mississippi State Penitentiary, and then to Greenwood LaFleur Hospital. He died of septic shock the following day. When Hain performed the autopsy on Cheney, he determined that Cheney had died of hypertensive heart disease and coronary artery disease, and ruled the manner of death to be natural. In his autopsy report, Hain indicated that he had weighed Cheney's spleen and that it was within the normal range of an adult man. Hain added that after removing and examining it, he found the spleen capsule intact with no contusions. It could perhaps be dismissed as a careless but forgivable oversight by a busy medical examiner if Hain had merely failed to note that Cheney's spleen was diseased as he removed it, weighed it, dissected it, and commented on its appearance. What actually happened is far less forgivable. Cheney's spleen had been removed 4 years earlier. This wasn't a frivolous oversight. A diseased, compromised, or missing spleen can increase the risk of sepsis. Then there's the sad case of Hattie Douglas. In August 2006, Douglas, a resident of Camden, Mississippi, fell asleep with her 11-month-old son, Kadarius, asleep on her chest. When she woke the next morning, Kadarius was unresponsive. He died before he got to the hospital. Haines' original autopsy report on the boy indicated no signs of alcohol poisoning. He then sent blood samples off to a Texas-based lab called Expertox for testing. When the tests came back, it showed Kadarius had an off-the-charts blood alcohol level of 0.4. A child of Kadarius's size would had to have ingested 5 to 6 ounces of pure alcohol to reach that level. Based on the toxicology results, the local coroner concluded that Kadarius died of ethyl alcohol intoxication. Hattie Douglas was arrested, charged with murder, and held without bond. She faced a possible sentence of life in prison. Her remaining 5 children were taken from her, and local law enforcement officials pilloried her in the press. Douglas and her family had maintained from the start that the child had been sick, and she had given him only cough medicine. She had even taken him to a medical clinic 3 days earlier for coughing and congestion. In July 2007, Douglas's attorney asked former Alabama State Medical Examiner Leroy Riddick to review Haines' autopsy and the toxicology reports. Riddick found that Haines had ignored or overlooked evidence in his autopsy that clearly conflicted with elevated alcohol reading. For one, with such a high level of intoxication, Haines should have noted a strong stench of alcohol during the autopsy. He hadn't. There were no other signs of intoxication either, just the lab report. Moreover, Expertox had actually run several tests on the sample from Kadarius Douglas. One test showed a concentration as low as 0.02, about what one would expect after a dose of cough medicine. The alcohol concentration then increased with ensuing tests. Haines and the authorities ran with the highest one. Haines and local officials blamed Expertox. But a spokeswoman for the company told the Clarion Ledger that the results were likely because someone in Mississippi had stored the sample at the wrong temperature. Another tube of the child's blood had been contaminated. In fact, the company had actually stopped taking lab samples from Mississippi in 2006. "We didn't feel as comfortable with samples coming from that state as we did from other states," a company official said. But even if the faulty test were solely the responsibility of Expertox, a conscientious medical examiner should have noticed such an abnormally high result and consulted his autopsy notes before agreeing to change his conclusions to support a murder charge. Haines didn't, and an innocent woman who had just suffered the loss of her son, then lost custody of her 4 other children, and spent 18 months in jail. On May 9, 2003, Christy Folgham, age 26, picked up her half-brother, Tyler Edmonds, and brought him to her home in the Longview community in Oktibbeha County, Mississippi. Edmonds, age 13, spent every other weekend with Folgham. On this particular weekend, he thought she was taking him to see their father. Instead, she took him to the house she shared with her husband, Joey. Christy and Joey Folgham had a volatile marriage. Christy told her family that Joey sometimes beat her and her 3 children. But acquaintances also said that Christy could be manipulative and was seeing other men. She had previously moved out of the house, but then moved back in, believing she was the beneficiary of her husband's $300,000 life insurance policy. Tyler Edmonds adored and idolized his half-sister. She often took advantage of that, using him to run interference on the various men in her life. Before she picked him up that weekend, she asked Tyler to bring her an old rifle from his stepfather's closet so she could shoot a stray dog that had been bothering her and her kids. She had also previously asked a couple of neighbors for a gun, using the same story. But according to her father, Christy wanted the guns for another reason. She planned to kill her husband to put an end to his abuse, after which she and her kids would live off of his life insurance policy. On that particular night, a Friday evening, Tyler, Christy, Joey, and the 3 children had dinner, watched a movie, and went to sleep. At around 4 a.m., Christy woke Tyler and told him she was leaving. She asked him to help her put the three kids in the car. According to Tyler, as he was waiting in the car, he heard a pop, but didn't think much of it at the time. Christy rushed to the car carrying a computer and jewelry box. At that point, she told Tyler that they weren't going to visit their father after all. They were going to Jackson to pick up her boyfriend, and then to Biloxi on the Gulf Coast. They did just that. The five of them spent that Saturday night at Biloxi's Beau Rivage Casino and Resort. When they returned to Jackson the following afternoon, Joey Fulghum had been found dead, shot once in the head as he slept. According to Tyler, that Sunday evening, Christy confessed to him that she had killed her husband. She also told him that they'd likely give her the death penalty, and that his only chance to continue seeing her and her kids would be for him to take the blame for the crime. She told him to tell the police that it was all an accident, that he had mistakenly shot Joey while playing with the gun. She assured him he wouldn't go to prison because he was still a juvenile. After dropping Tyler back off with his mother, Christy was interrogated at the Oktibbeha County Jail. She blamed her husband's death on Tyler. The police asked Tyler's mother to bring him in for questioning. While he was still in the presence of his mother and with a camera rolling, the police questioned him for 3 hours. Tyler repeatedly denied any involvement in Joey Fulghum's death. He was then separated from his mother and questioned alone. That's when the police interrogators told Tyler that Christy had already blamed him for Joey's death. He didn't believe them. Then they turned off the camera and brought Christy into the room. Christy took Tyler's hand and told him to tell the truth. As she did, she slipped him a note. The note instructed Tyler to tell the police that he shot Joey by accident. If he didn't, she wrote, "They want to see me fry." The police then turned the camera back on, and Tyler confessed, but with an odd and contradictory narrative. He claimed he and Christy had decided to carry out the murder together by holding the old rifle and pulling the trigger simultaneously as Joey slept. Tyler said he didn't even think the rifle would work. He said he had closed his eyes before they pulled the trigger, then opened one eye after he heard the shot. He said he saw specks of blood on a pillowcase. There was no blood at the crime scene. He said he then confessed to Christy's boyfriend while they were in Biloxi. Her boyfriend later denied it. 3 days later, after talking to his mother and other relatives, Tyler recanted his entire confession. He said he had falsely confessed because he thought that by taking some but not all of the blame, he could save his sister from getting the death penalty. Forrest Allgood's office filed murder charges against both Tyler and Christy and announced that Tyler would be tried as an adult. The only real evidence against Edmonds was his confession, but he had recanted it. So the prosecution needed jurors to believe the confession over the recantation. That's where Hayne came in. At trial, the prosecutor in the case, one of Allgood's assistants, asked Hayne if he had viewed Tyler's videotaped confession. He said he had. She then asked if, in light of that confession, he had considered the position of Joey's body. He said he had. She then asked, based on the path of the projectile and everything that was viewed, if Hayne thought the defendant's version of the events is consistent with what you found in Mr. Fulghum. In other words, she asked, were the wounds in Fulghum's body consistent with Edmonds's initial confession, the one in which he and his sister held and fired the gun simultaneously? Edmonds's attorney objected, arguing that to answer that question would require knowledge outside of anything in his report and also outside of anybody's expertise. He requested a Daubert hearing on the scientific bases, if any even existed, to suggest it was possible for a medical examiner to conclude from a victim's wounds whether there was one or two people holding the gun used to commit the crime. The judge refused to even hold a hearing. The prosecutor then asked the question again. Did Hayne find that the crime scene evidence, his autopsy, and the other forensic evidence to be consistent with Tyler's videotaped confession? Hayne answered, within a reasonable medical certainty, it's consistent with the scenario provided to me and would be in compliance with the facts that I saw. The question was absurd, and so was Haynes' answer. There's simply no way a medical examiner could have known such a thing. Tyler's attorneys undoubtedly knew exactly what Haynes had just done. He had found language that allowed the jury to hear an opinion that wasn't really defensible, while permitting him to avoid stating that indefensible opinion explicitly. So on cross-examination, the defense provoked Haynes to be more explicit. They asked straight up if he believed the evidence suggested that two people fired the shot. He said it did. They then asked if he thought just one person could have fired. He answered, "I could not exclude that. However, I would favor that a second party be involved in that positioning of the weapon." That answer would prove to be the beginning of the end of Haynes' stranglehold on Mississippi's autopsies. Later in the trial, there was another battle over expert testimony that provided a striking contrast to the debate over Haynes' two-hands-on-the-gun theory. Edmonds' defense attorneys had planned to question Allison Redlich, a trained experimental psychologist who had conducted research into false confessions, particularly among children. Redlich was prepared to testify that Edmonds was a prototypical candidate for a false confession. In addition to his being separated from his mother and pressured by his sister, a court-ordered psychological evaluation had found that Edmonds was emotionally and psychologically immature for his age, all common factors among those known to have falsely confessed. The state preemptively objected. Despite allowing Haynes' absurd gun-holding testimony without even so much as a hearing, the trial judge set aside an entire day for a Daubert hearing on whether Redlich's research was scientifically credible. After the hearing, the judge ruled that it wasn't. His analysis was a case study in the folly of asking judges to be the gatekeepers of science in the courtroom. For example, one of the judge's self-selected criteria for determining whether Redlich's research was valid was how often other courts had permitted expert testimony about false confessions. His own research showed that about half had allowed it and half didn't. This, he decided, meant that Redlich's opinions hadn't yet been accepted in the scientific community. It was a revealing bit of analysis. Whether other judges had allowed a particular field of research into evidence said little to nothing about whether that field had been accepted in the scientific community. The judge also claimed that the number of researchers in the field of false confessions was too small for the field to be considered scientifically accepted. He claimed only 6 were doing work similar to Redlich's. But the actual number was around 60, and one review of published research on false confessions in 1992, more than a decade before the Edmonds trial, found 800 different peer-reviewed studies. Of the 3 experts the judge did cite who had questioned the frequency of false confessions, one had never published a peer-reviewed study on the topic. Another is a former federal judge, victims' rights and death penalty advocate, and a conservative legal commentator, not a trained psychiatrist or social scientist. For nearly 20 years, Mississippi's courts had permitted the testimony of Michael West without so much as a single Daubert hearing to entertain the possibility that his methods and practices may have lacked scientific merit. For 20 years, they had allowed Stephen Haynes to testify, despite his lack of certification and absurd workload, and in areas well outside the parameters of forensic pathology, including blood spatter on walls, the positioning of shooters based on bullet trajectories, and tool mark identification. But it was on the subject of false confessions that this particular court suddenly grew skeptical. The jury found Edmonds guilty. In October 2003, he was sentenced to life in prison. He was 16 years old at the time. He wouldn't be eligible for parole until he turned 65. In a separate trial, Christie was also convicted. She was sentenced to death. Haynes' preposterous testimony in the Edmonds case was later upheld by the Mississippi Court of Appeals. The majority of that court, along with Haynes' defenders, pointed to the fact that in his confession, Edmund said he closed his eyes before shooting. They argued that Hayne wasn't claiming he could tell there were two hands on the trigger, but merely that if Edmund's eyes were closed, it would only make sense that Christy Fulghum's hand helped guide the gun, otherwise Edmund's would have missed. That's certainly one interpretation of his testimony. On its own, it seems plausible, if unlikely. But it's more easily dismissed by the state's own opening argument, in which the prosecutor explicitly told the jury, "You're going to hear how Christy stood behind him and held him, and you're going to hear how they both put their finger on the trigger, and you're going to hear how they both shot and killed Joey Fulghum." In a surprise decision handed down in January 2007, the Mississippi Supreme Court granted Tyler Edmonds a new trial. More surprising, for the first time ever, the court overturned a conviction because of testimony from Stephen Hayne. The majority explicitly ruled that Hayne's two-hands-on-the-gun testimony wasn't supported by science. The vote was 7-1. But even in tossing Hayne's testimony in the case, the majority went out of its way to emphasize that its criticism of Hayne was limited only to the case at hand. It was not a comment on his general credibility, much less a suggestion that he should no longer testify in court. The majority also upheld the trial judge's exclusion of the evidence from Allison Redlich about false confessions. Two justices would have gone further. Oliver Diaz wrote a concurring opinion, joined by Justice James Graves, in which he explicitly called on his colleagues to pay rigorous attention to experts like Hayne and others when they attempt to testify in Mississippi's courts. Diaz cited Hayne's enormous autopsy workload, as well as the fact that he wasn't properly certified. Diaz also wrote that he would have admitted Redlich's testimony about false confessions and would not have admitted Edmonds's taped confession. Justice Charles Easley, who had defeated Chief Justice Prather in 2000 by accusing her of being soft on crime, was the lone dissenter. He would have upheld Edmonds's conviction. But even that wasn't the case at first. It was later revealed that the justices had initially voted in favor of upholding Edmonds's conviction. Diaz responded with a dissent so blistering and persuasive that several justices reversed their votes. Forrest Allgood decided to try Edmonds again. That trial took place in 2008. This time, without Hayne's two-hands-on-the-gun testimony, the jury quickly acquitted. The Edmonds case brought national attention to Mississippi, but nearly all of it focused on the fact that Edmonds was being tried as an adult for a crime he had allegedly committed at the age of 13. That was certainly worthy of attention. It seemed like an especially cruel decision. Edmonds had no prior criminal record, and his teachers, relatives, parents of his friends, and his school counselor all testified that he was a gentle and good-natured kid. He was well-behaved and got good grades and had never been prone to violence. Even if Allgood and his subordinates truly believed Edmonds helped his sister kill her husband, there was every reason to think he had been emotionally manipulated into doing it. At worst, this was a boy who came to the aid of the sociopathic older sister he adored and saw as a maternal figure. But as with the jailhouse suicides in the 1990s, despite the national attention from media outlets and various activist groups, the ongoing problems with the state's death investigation system still escaped much scrutiny, at least in the short term. The Mississippi Supreme Court ruling in Edmonds's case was a different matter. That decision started a chain of events that would ultimately lead to Hayne's termination as a designated pathologist who could perform autopsies for prosecutors. It not only drew attention to his egregiously awful testimony in that case, which in itself should have spurred a thorough review of all of Hayne's work, but renewed the suspicions and criticisms of Hayne that had percolated among his critics and colleagues for years. Hayne's reign was coming to an end. After receiving Kennedy Brewer's letter, the attorneys at the Innocence Project in New York agreed to represent him. Shortly after Brewer had been cleared by DNA testing, but well before he had been exonerated, his attorneys from both Mississippi and New York paid a visit to Forrest Allgood in Macon. The prosecutor had already announced that he planned to try Brewer again. The legal team wanted to make a personal plea to Allgood to drop the charges. What happened next, as recounted by André Degree and Peter Neufeld, was remarkable. The attorneys, along with Brewer himself, were to meet with Allgood in the jury room of a Noxubee County courthouse. Only after Brewer left the room did Allgood agree to talk. He then brought them back to an office in the courthouse and took a seat behind a desk. He leaned back, propped up his cowboy boots, and crossed his feet. Neufeld carefully explained the science behind DNA testing, why the science in this case proved Brewer's innocence, and why the U.S. Constitution compelled Allgood to drop the charges. When Neufeld had finished, Allgood slowly looked up from the floor, paused, and said, "You really believe in this science stuff, don't you?" Stunned, Neufeld replied that, indeed, he really did believe in DNA and in science. Allgood shrugged, took his boots off the table, and said, "Well, I guess everybody's gotta believe in something." When asked about the conversation, Allgood denied making the first comment. "I have never disbelieved in DNA," he wrote, adding that he does sometimes object to how DNA test results are interpreted. He does recall making the second comment. "We had multiple experts saying this guy was innocent. We had two labs confirm the DNA tests. We were thinking, we just need to round up as many scientists as we can. More confirmation, more tests. Eventually we'd convince Allgood that our client is innocent," Degree says. "That conversation was such a revelation. The fact is, none of it mattered. We were dealing with a guy who thought science was just another set of beliefs, just another religion that wasn't his. You can see how a guy like that, how once he's convinced someone is guilty, he just isn't going to stop." The core problem with the medico-legal system in Mississippi is that it's easily manipulated. It serves those in power. Historically, it has served as a means of preserving the state's white power structure. But that's only because those in power wanted it that way. At some point between the early 1980s and the mid-2000s, the respectable politics on the race issue in Mississippi shifted from defending the past to apologizing for it, to trying to reckon with it in order to move beyond it. As the state's politicians positioned themselves over the course of that shift, the state's death investigation system evolved to serve them. The cold case trial of James Ford Seal is a good example of how the system changed to accommodate the new era. By late June 1964, state and federal authorities found the bodies of Henry D. and Charles Moore while looking for the missing Freedom Summer workers. D. was a 19-year-old sawmill employee, Moore a 20-year-old college student at Alcorn State. They lived in Meadville, Mississippi, a small community about 30 miles east of Natchez, along the northern border of the Homochitto National Forest. The area also happened to be the home of one of the most violent factions of the state Ku Klux Klan, known as the Silver Dollar Group. Immediately after the bodies were recovered, an aggressive investigation got underway. Unlike similar investigations of that era, this one held promise. There were witnesses, and they were talking. On May 2, 1964, James Ford Seal picked up Dee and Moore as they hitchhiked near a gas station in Meadville. He posed as a federal revenue agent investigating local moonshine activity. Seal then drove them deep into the Homochitto National Forest to a waiting group of Klansmen, who tied Dee and Moore to trees and repeatedly lashed them with bean poles. The two men's bodies, alleged to be badly beaten but not yet dead, were then driven 100 miles west to a boat launch by an isolated part of the Mississippi River. Seal and a fellow Klansman were arrested in November 1964. They would later successfully convince the local white community that they had been beaten by federal law enforcement during their arrest and brief imprisonment. Instead of a pretrial hearing in January, the district attorney moved to dismiss the indictments. The murders were not likely Seal's first. He was believed to have killed another Klan member who was trying to get out of the organization and was suspected of providing information to the FBI. 6 months later, he was believed to have murdered a 74-year-old black man, one of the few black residents of Franklin County brave enough to have registered to vote. The coroner's jury failed to bring charges in either case. In 2007, after years of pressure and activism by Charles Moore's brother Thomas, Seal was charged in federal court with one count of conspiracy to commit kidnapping and two counts of kidnapping. But the federal prosecutors would need to surmount a number of problems with the case. Witnesses had died, and there was at least some residual resistance to pursuing a case that would potentially reopen old wounds and stir up racial strife. But the most critical problem at first seemed intractable: jurisdiction. In order to get jurisdiction for federal kidnapping charges, the government had to show that a living victim, in this case Dee or Moore or both, had been transported across state lines after being kidnapped. They would have to prove that Dee and Moore were killed after they were taken from the Homochito Forest into Louisiana and then back again into Mississippi, that they were still alive when they were thrown into the river. The evidence for this was thin. None of the witness statements at the time indicated as much. The only witness willing to say decades later that the men were alive was himself a former Klansman with a history of lying about the case. What prosecutors needed was a medical examiner willing to review old records, autopsy Dee's and Moore's remains, and determine that they had died of drowning. The old autopsies, however, offered no help. Drowning is a difficult diagnosis even with a fresh body. But the indications of drowning, water in their stomachs or lungs, changes to the blood vessels in the eyes, wouldn't be discernible in the remains of two bodies that had been cut in half, submerged in the river for weeks, and buried for more than 40 years. As part of the initial forensic investigation in the 1960s, the bones had been sent to one of the preeminent forensic anthropologists in the country, Dr. J. Lawrence Angel, at the Smithsonian National Museum of Natural History. Angel could make no determination about cause of death. At best, freshwater drowning was not inconsistent with the available evidence. That wouldn't be enough to establish jurisdiction. Decades later, as a new prosecution was being considered, federal prosecutors consulted Stephen Hain. Hain wasn't nearly as circumspect as Angel had been. He found that, to a reasonable degree of medical certainty, the cause of death was consistent with freshwater drowning, but testified that the condition of the body precluded a definite conclusion. Still, that was what federal prosecutors needed to establish jurisdiction. In August 2007, James Ford Seal was convicted and sentenced to three life terms for his role in the 1964 murders of Dee and Moore. He died in the federal penitentiary in Terre Haute, Indiana, in 2011. James Ford Seal wasn't a sympathetic figure. He was an unapologetic racist and a Klansman, and he almost certainly committed multiple murders. He should have been tried locally in 1964. There was plenty of evidence and plenty of witnesses who were still alive. But in 1964, Mississippi wasn't ready to try a white man for murdering two young black men. And the sad fact of the matter is, 40 years later, there still wasn't much of an appetite for it. In truth, as Harry N. McLean writes in his book about the murders and trial, if it had been solely up to the authorities, this latest act in Mississippi's redemption drama would not have been prosecuted. Seal's trial could only be conducted by the federal government, in Jackson, away from Meadville. When the United States decided to prosecute Seal in 2007, the entire endeavor was largely symbolic. There were at least seven Klansmen who were involved in the abduction and murder of Dee and Morris. In the end, only one ever stood trial, and by the time he did, he was a doddering old man. At its heart, Seale's trial was about declaring that the rule of law was alive in Mississippi, that it could bring the worst among us to justice, even if that justice was considerably and inexcusably delayed. But as federal judge Harold DeMoss wrote in a dissent to the appeals court decision upholding Seale's conviction, our treatment